Welcome back to Mark's Madness, now part of Chunkaluta.
We've added a cold open.
We've evolved.
We're just going to go for it. No news.
No, there is a news item.
Yeah.
You may have heard.
You may have heard about this little incident that happened in front of an Israeli consulate. I think it's probably important to stay serious in this discussion now that we've quickly moved past the initial joke.
Yeah.
You know, for those unaware, how do you say his last name?
Aaron Bushnell, who was a member of the Air Force, had self-immolated, which is where you light yourself on fire with suicidal intent, but not necessarily from the same reasons as suicide, right? It's less of a pain or mental health, struggle and depression struggle like suicide, and more of something very intentional where you're choosing to die publicly, where people can stop you and people can see you in a very painful way, in a very specific protest, right? It is a protest that has been used sparsely throughout history and generally very effectively. And Aaron Bushnell felt that he was part of a genocide, complicit in the genocide, being part of the Air Force. I believe the quote on social media he said was, "I've been complicit in the violent domination of the world, and I will never get that blood off my hands." I can't remember what social media was on, but he wrote that on social media. And then self-immolating, he came up in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., which would be obviously near the base where he was at, and would be kind of the big Israeli embassy in the United States, where he would say that he would no longer be complicit in genocide. And then he proceeded to light himself on fire and shout "Free Palestine" as he burned.
He also said, "What I'm about to experience is nothing compared to what people are experiencing in Palestine."
Yes, which is very prescient, honestly, in more ways, not only because of the incredible pain of self-immolation and the incredible pain of being bombed and genocided and starved and the loss of family, but also that's a very specific way people die. I mean, bombings get very sanitized in the West, very, very sanitized, right? And we think there's very many painful aspects to it. You can be killed by shrapnel or collapsed buildings. You can be disoriented by noise in ways that could eventually kill you. You have obviously infrastructure that your life depends on destroyed. You can lose limbs, things like that. But one thing people don't appreciate is bombs are very hot. And if you are in the actual blast zone of an explosion and you don't die instantly, you are burned alive. So
there's a reason why the US after Vietnam started really reining in where the journalists can go and what they can take pictures of, because if you look up the photos of what was coming out of Vietnam, it is not pretty.
Well, that's the first war that was televised, right? Like, that's the first time people could go out. They had their own equipment. Like, I've met some of the people from that time. There was this, it was called the Video Freak Movement in upstate New York. And I mean, people were going, well-off white people were using their wealth to buy the equipment to film the necessary shit. Some of them would give away the equipment, which is the better move. But, opportunist gonna opportunize. But, it's incredible the footage people got during that time. And a lot of it's just not accessible because a lot of people don't trust. Out of that period, you have a lot of paranoia around fake journalists. Like Peter Matthiessen wrote one of the most well-known books on the American Indian movements, Infiltration by COINTELPRO agent Douglas Durham. It's called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. And he turned out to be a CIA agent. Well, he was fucking, informing on people he was interviewing.
An asset.
An asset. That's the word. My brain no good.
as someone who always forgets the damn word I'm looking for, I was like, oh, I could help.
But it's important to also, you know, when we're talking about things getting swept up, this isn't the first time somebody's self-immolated in front of a Israeli consulate. The reason why this one wasn't ignored was because it was a white military service person. So now you have to talk about it. It has to be talked about. Whether or not this was the best move for him, I don't know. You know, but he definitely didn't make it without reservation. I believe he left behind two kids. As, you know, a parent myself, that's like, you know, that's a sacrifice. And it's kind of sad. It happened on my birthday. So it's also like...
Happy birthday.
Ooh, I'll never forget that one. Hmm. And he's the same age as me. So it's just like, I don't know. It kind of, you know, that's a name that's going to go down in history, but it reminds me a lot of the Buddhist monk during Vietnam who starts with a T. I forget the name off the top of my head, but I'd have to Google it and I feel bad Googling it. But, you know, it's ultimate.
I was going to say, I'm
you're going to fuck it up. Yeah,
that's what I'm worried about is fucking it up. But it's like Thich Quang Duch or Thich Quang Duc was the Buddhist monk.
But it's like a very symbolic act of, you know, people who have no power on the individual level, right? Like this is probably one of the most powerful acts an individual can do if, you know, well planned.
But it is limited. It's, you know, it's going to be powerful, but just like many other types of protest, it's one of many strategies that needs to be used in conjunction with other strategies. And it's not always the best decision for a specific revolutionary, because like we've talked about before, you know, it's the ultimate sacrifice, right? Like a lot of people huff themselves up on supporting empire and doing good and stuff like that when they're supporting something horrible and evil because they're making the ultimate sacrifice. That's the heroism of joining the military. Now you have, you know, someone in the Air Force actually making a moral choice and making that ultimate sacrifice. But also, you know, for the vast majority of us, you know, we said you've got to be willing to die, but want to live for the revolution.
Right. It's that revolutionary suicide, right? Live as if you are already dead, you know, but you know, somebody like that, that's that dedicated, you know, channeling that kind of energy, like that level of energy, you know, that's you're ride or die, literally. You know, channeling that's probably more beneficial to the, and I mean, like, we shouldn't really pontificate too much upon it, but you know, it's our job as revolutionaries now to take this martyrdom to agitate around it and push for, you know, the future that, you know, he envisioned. And if y'all haven't been looking into what else he said besides what he said on that video, you really should, because so many people are limiting it to Palestine. This man was very much in favor of indigenous liberation here. You know, he was a land back person, you know, so like when people, you know, are shitting on land back from now on, you got to remember that that's what this dude was talking about. I'm not fucking joking. Like, go and read the shit he was saying. It's, you know, I really wish, you know, I could have met the guy and talked to him. I would have liked to think I could have, you know, done what I've done many times before with radical people that are being pushed to the edge by their circumstances. This isn't something that's new to me. It's something I deal with a lot. You know, a lot of people don't realize what happens behind the scenes and stuff. You know, they only see what I do on Twitter. But like, I get reached out to about some pretty dire circumstances and stuff. And, you know, defusing that without calling the cops is an important skill for parties to have, because we're not professionals. So it takes a lot of care to do that without hurting people, you know, the person you're helping included. But, you know, something like this is something you honor, you know, like to us, when you burn something like that, you know, it's a sacrifice, it's a prayer, you know, you can hear what his prayer was. He made sure we heard it. You know, when you suffer like that, you're suffering for the people. It's not something you're doing individually. you know, it might be done as an individual, but it's something he's doing for a collective, not just himself, you know, and that collective is the collective humanity of all, you know. It's depraved what's happening. This is what Nazi Germany was like. There's no other way to describe what we're seeing. And the, I don't even know how to describe it, but the lack of humanity liberals have, you know, the, I don't know.
It goes back to the you know, expression, because it's not just expression. It's very, very true analysis is, you know, you want to say like, what would I be doing if I lived in Nazi Germany? Well, what are you doing now?
Oh, and that's exactly what he posed, right? Like that's, you know, what he posted on Facebook was, you know, a lot of people ask, what would they do? Well, you're answering it every day. Every day you go on, the choices you make, that's what you would have been doing. And what's sad is this isn't new. You know, people have always been doing this while genocide goes on underneath their feet to indigenous nations. There's a reason Mayan reservation has a 300% infant mortality rate, and isn't that we don't know how to manage our resources.
Did you just say 300?
300%. Gaza only reached that level during this genocide. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's 300% based on the national average.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, we don't have our own national statistics.
Yeah, no, 300% of the national average.
Yeah, I should clarify. Sorry. But
I was like, hold on, are like babies coming out of thin air?
And Sorry. Should clarify. Because also when somebody's like, how? It's like, yeah, isn't that unbelievable? But yeah, no. So it's a 300% infant mortality. You know, it's a 50-year life expectancy, 48 for men. You know, like that's the lowest in the world. Were we an independent nation? Like, that's a fact. It's really fucked up. And that's happening in South Dakota. You know, like, every day, what you do is what you would do if you were in Nazi Germany or during Jim Crow. Every day, whatever you're doing, that's what you would do. Think about that. So anyway,
we are now a Maoist podcast.
Yeah.
We use anytime you hear America or anything else, we are using Maoist standard English.
3 Ks. Thank you.
Triple S's, all of that.
Is it triple S? I thought it was a double S.
Yeah, whichever.
But anyway, we will go on reading and not throw out shade at the Maoists anymore. So it is slide 172, The Modern Prince Essays on the Science of Politics in the Modern Age. Ooh, what a fancy title. Who's reading first? Is it me?
Well, should we give a background on this? Does everyone know what the modern...
You should give a background on this, because yeah, I don't know shit. Do we know
who Machiavelli is and all of this shit?
That's a good point. You should do this. Go on, Prez. You have the floor.
Okay, so this essay is essentially Gramsci trying to write his outline for what the ideal Communist Party should be in Italy. So really pay attention and read this.
Take out your fucking notes, people.
Go read it. Highlight like every other sentence and all of that shit.
I got the screenshot tool out. I'm like, all right.
And because he's in prison when he's writing this, he has to avoid the censors. So he is using the phrase, the modern prince. And if you don't know what he's alluding to, he's referring to Machiavelli's The Prince, which was a book back in the Machiavelli was the 1400s.
No, Machiavelli's big work is The Prince, which is about sordid politics during the Renaissance.
So Machiavelli's big thing is The Prince. He was in the Renaissance. He was mid to late 1400s, early 1500s. His big thing was The Prince. Losers will say that The Prince was, he was writing some sarcastic thing about what you shouldn't do if you want people to like you. Really, he was writing a really good thing about how you want to run a country. This is like one of the first works of political science in modern history, as we would consider political science. Before this, in, you know, even if we want to not be Eurocentric and we want to include India and China and, you know, the Islamic countries, Ottoman, Persia, Japan, whatever, those are mostly philosophical texts. This was the first attempt to be a piece of political analysis.
I'd argue the wampum belt, but that's just me.
When would that happen?
1200.
You see, this is why I'm a good academic. I always hedge my bets. I said one of the first.
Yeah. There you go. Make sure to add a disclaimer.
This way no one can tell me I'm being too general. One of the first. Most other things were generally philosophical, and this was one of the first things that really tried to just be like, you know what, fuck philosophy. This is practical analysis. This is just what you do.
Well, see, a lot of people would probably hear like oral history and be like, that's philosophical, but it's also like, no, it's another language, and you just, you know, being lost in translation.
Yeah. So we also hear him reference Machiavelli a bunch of times. He considers, Gramsci considers Machiavelli one of the greatest political thinkers in European history. That is, of course, up for debate, but as we've seen him talk about education, and we'll see him talk about it more later, he's really into the idea of studying the classics. So he's really into kind of all of this kind of stuff anyway. But because in Machiavelli's work, The Prince, he's talking about the principle, like this is feudal times, right? So you have the prince acting and he is the political actor. So for Gramsci, he's essentially being very humble and is being the new Machiavelli. And the party is the modern prince. So if for Machiavelli, the prince was the sole political actor that has to do all of these things to have a good society where people don't rise up and then the economy works and everyone's happy and all of that sunshines and rainbows stuff, the modern prince is the party. So that's the general background. So this is going to be him incorporating all of the stuff we've been learning about hegemony and civil society and political society into what the party should be doing.
So this is like the climax of our study, huh?
No, because we're going to have stuff after this.
This is a lead up to the climax. Okay.
Yeah. Because then after this, it's all like culture stuff. This is structural still. This is how the party should operate.
This is the climax of Gramsci's structural analysis.
Yeah.
There, that's what I wanted to say. I'm going to say. Okay. I'm just going to take credit for what Dave. Notes on Machiavelli's politics. The fundamental characteristic of The Prince is that it is not a systematic treatment, but a living book in which political ideology and political science are fused in the dramatic form of a myth. In contrast to the Utopia and the Scholastic Tract, the forms in which political science was expressed before Machiavelli. Wait. Okay. This treatment was given his conception the form of fantasy and art by its doctrinal and rational element is embodied in the person of a condottiere. What's that mean? Condottiere?
I have no idea.
What the fuck? Okay. Shh. It's the first paragraph and you don't know. Gramsci expert, leader my ass.
Of a troop of mercenaries in Romance, Italy.
Representing plastically and anthropomorphically the symbol of the collective will. The process of formation of a determined collective will or a determined political end is here. It sounds like he's directly combating some of the fascist rhetoric around will and shit like that.
I wonder who locked him in prison that he would need.
Yeah, yeah. No, I just find it interesting that that's how he opens up, you know, like it's a, like a treatise against fascism's mythology.
Well, because like he's trying to construct a party. His whole thing is that the part. So the whole reason why he's talking about the party, as we're going to see, is that the party isn't just a political thing you join and you organize and whatever. It's going to be guiding the state. And the state consists of politics, economics, and culture. So the party should be guiding every aspect of life. And he's going to be threading a really fine line, and we're going to see kind of a... I see some carryovers with Mao in a way. He's going to be threading a very fine line with how do you have a party really... How would you have a party really embrace people's everyday living situation, how people think, how people act, how do they walk down the street, how do they buy bread, how do they go to school, without it being so overly bureaucratic, or they even know that the party's there and they end up just resenting the party because they think it's just, you know, a singular authoritarian state that just dictates things on a whim. So he has this kind of like humanistic idea of what the party should be, that it should be society itself.
Well, that's interesting because that does ring a lot about Mao. It makes me wonder, who came first, the chicken or the egg?
They're at the same time.
Well, right. But like, was Mao hearing these arguments in the commenter when Gramsci was going there, because you can see like where these are starting, right?
So there's another podcast called People's History of Ideas, and okay,
I'll go to check that out.
Yeah, it's like 20-minute snippets. He eventually wants to go into the Shining Path, but he's been spending like 4 years talking about the revolution in China. He's like, to talk about the Shining Path, we need to talk about Mao.
Well, yeah,
which rules, but he's giving like a day by day of the revolution, so it's awesome.
Well, I mean, hey, that's cool, but at the same time, that's a long ass revolution.
Oh,
and 10 years of it, Mao's like, I wish we just didn't do that.
But so, like, if you listen to that, or if you just read a bunch of other stuff, you'll get the sense that the Chinese communists weren't super invested in attending the Comintern a lot. They were more interested in fighting.
Doing
the revolution.
I'm like, I don't really want to write down my thoughts. I'm busy organizing.
Yeah. And the Italian communists were also busy actively fighting fascism. So they also had to a lesser degree strengthen the Comintern. So there was never really much interaction between the Chinese and Italian communists. But that would be something really cool to actually look into.
I just want to know more about those, like, hallway conversations that were going on, like, because you can tell the Italians were definitely along the lines of, like, you know, Mao's positioning with the Third World Movement and stuff, that it's like, well, you gotta fucking learn how to fucking talk to the colonizers, you fucking idiots.
I think it's also that, remember the Southern question?
Well, that too, yeah.
I think it's that Italy was also heavily underdeveloped.
Well, I think I'm trying to determine
population.
I'm trying to determine how, well, right, I guess the peasantry is definitely a major point in that, but I'm trying to determine how much is the material conditions independently enabling them to come to the same conclusions versus these are active conversations they
there's
exchange, you know.
Yeah, I'd be interested too, but there's some, you know, some rational reasons to believe it's the first too, because
it seems like it. Like,
at the time both were coming out, you had Stalin and Trotsky going at it with, you know, socialism one country and permanent revolution, and obviously we've gone on and on about what's wrong with permanent revolution. You can't just keep fighting everywhere and, you know, no borders and try to take everybody down. And Trotsky also had this thing we didn't get into where it was like only certain parts of each society you revolutionize one at a time, but it's across all the border. It was a big fucking mess, permanent revolution. The end of it, the conclusion of what to do was stupid as hell, and there's a reason Stalin won that fight. But there was an unequal development belief built in there, and when you press that against the national question, against the colonized conditions that these revolutionaries came out of, it all adds up. It all makes sense, you know? And I think that's where maybe we don't give enough... I've told before, like, we give Trotsky a lot of grief, and we should, but
there's a reason why
he was a revolutionary, and yeah, and he brought some good stuff to the table, you know, kind of along the lines of the way the Black Panther Party had people read about Garvey type stuff, you know.
Well, and we'll have, you know, our session on decolonial Marxism come up on the feed and stuff, but, you know, Walter specifically makes this argument in there that, you know, let us just forego the great man conversation for just a little bit. Who cares if it's Mao, Trotsky, or Stalin? What did they contribute, you know, and why do we value them? You know, let's ask ourselves that, you know, and we come to, oh, we're fucking trying to liberate ourselves, so let's maybe fucking not disagree over settled arguments. Maybe there's a reason why democratic centralism existed, and maybe we should be learning from the past. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's kind of makes it more interesting of with Gramsci going into Machiavelli here along the same lines, right? Because, like, no one would line up, like, you know, Marx, Engels, Machiavelli or anything like that. But, like, look how useful these ideas are to Gramsci and using that rather than think of the person. And if I remember right, Stalin actually looked a lot like kept pretty rigorous notes of Machiavelli too.
Well, man, if we think saying these debates have been settled over 100 years ago is tiresome and petty, imagine going, this debate has been settled 400 years ago. Why are we still talking about this?
True. As an indigenous person, I'm saying that a lot. Like, my elders are like, this, why are people homeless? There was a time where you just gave a guy a house. What happened to that?
The good old days.
I think my partner just started the laundry. My lights flickered. But anyway, so let us continue since we made it a fucking paragraph in. The process of formation of a determined collective will for a determined political end is here represented not through disquisitions and pedantic classifications of the principles and criteria of a mode of action, but through the qualities, characteristic traits, duties, necessities of a concrete person, which excite the artistic fantasy of those he wants to convince and give a more concrete form of political passions. The Prince of Machiavelli could be studied as an historical example of the Sorellian myth, that is, of political ideology, which is not presented as a cold utopia or as a rational doctrine, but as a creation of a concrete fantasy which works on a dispersed and pulverized people in order to arouse and organize their collective will. The utopian characteristic of the prince lies in the fact that the prince did not exist in historical reality, did not present himself to the Italian people in a directly objective way, but was a purely doctrinaire abstraction, the symbol of a leader, the ideal. But the emotional mythical element contained throughout this small book with very effective dramatic movement are recapitulated and come to life in the conclusion, the innovation of a, quote, really existing, end quote, prince.
Really existing party.
Throughout the book, Machiavelli deals with what the prince must be in order to lead the people towards the foundation of a new state. The argument is conducted with rigorous logic, with scientific detachment. In the conclusion, Machiavelli makes himself, the people merges himself with the people, makes himself the people, merges himself with the people, not with the people in a general sense, but with the people whom Machiavelli has convinced with the preceding tract, whose conscious expression he becomes and feels himself to be, with whom he feels himself identified. It seems that the whole of the, quote, logical work is only a reflection of the people, an internal reasoning which takes place inside the popular consciousness and has its conclusions in an impassioned, urgent cry. Passion, from reasoning about itself, becomes emotion, fever, fanaticism for action. That is why the epilogue of the prince is not something extrinsic, quote, stuck on, end quote, from outside, rhetorical, but must be understood as a necessary part of the work. And moreover, as the part which sheds a true light over the whole work and makes it seem like a political manifesto. We can study how Sorel did not advance from the conception of the ideology myth to understanding the political party, but stopped short at the conception of the trade union. It is true that Sorel, the quote myth, did not find its greatest expression in the union as an organization of collective will, but in the practical action of the union, of an already operating collective will, practical action, whose greatest realization was, according to him, the general strike, that is passive activity, so to speak. For a negative and preliminary character, the positive character, is provided only by the agreement reached by the associated wills, end quote, and an activity which does not envisage its own, quote, active and constructive, end quote, phase. In Sorel, there are two necessities where these two necessities, in Sorel, therefore, two necessities were in conflict, that of the myth and that of the criticism of the myth, since every pre-established plan is utopian and reactionary. The solution was itself to irrational impulse, to chance, in the Bergsonian sense of vital impulse, or to spontaneity. But can a myth be non-constructive? Can it be imagined, according to Sorel's intuitions, that an instrument is productive of an effect which, to Sorel's intuitions, that an which leaves the collective will to the primitive and elementary phase of its mere formation, through distinction, parentheses, through splitting away, and parentheses, even though with violence, that is, by destroying existing moral and even though with violence, that is, by destroying existing moral and legal relations, will not this collective will thus elementarily form, elementarily formed, immediately cease to exist and be scattered in an infinity of single wills, which for the positive phase follow different and contrasting directions. In addition, there is the question that destruction negation cannot exist without an implicit construction affirmation and not in a, quote, metaphysical sense, but in practice, i.e. politically as a party program. In this case, we see that behind spontaneity is presupposed pure mechanicalism. Behind freedom, parentheses, vital will drive, okay, in parentheses, a maximum of determinism behind idealism and absolute materialism. I call it maximalist utopianism, but no. The modern prince, the myth prince, cannot be a real person, a concrete individual. It can only be an organism, a complex element of society in which the cementing of collective will, recognized and partially asserted in action, has already begun. This organism is already provided by historical development and I just had an argument on Twitter today about historical development. I'm going to fucking freak the fuck out. This dude's an Italian communist, too. I'm like, dude, fucking read Gramsci, dude. Shut the fuck up.
Well, the Italian communist gave up Gramsci for and then invented Euro communism. So, you know.
That makes a lot of sense now. Okay, where was I? Jesus Christ, that just pissed me off. And it is the political party, the first cell containing the germs of collective will, which are striving to become universal and total. In the modern world, only an immediate and imminent historical political action characterized by the necessity of rapid and lightning movement can be mythically embodied in a concrete individual. This rapidity can only be rendered necessary by a great imminent danger, a great danger which is in fact brings about simultaneously the inflaming of passions and fanaticism, abolishing critical sense, and the corroding irony which can destroy the, quote, divine character of a parentheses, which is what happened to the Bollinger Adventure. What's the Bollinger Adventure again?
That's a good question. Oh, that was the Italian general in World War One, they were attacking Austria, and anytime they would fail, they would just be like, you know what? Let's go again.
Trench warfare was beautiful.
Same thing, except there were no trenches. They would just go over the same fucking river in the same formation because the fucking guy thought it was honorable or whatever.
Didn't you read about Rome? What the fuck? not doing your predecessors well. But immediate action of this kind, by its very name, this is almost like Custerism. Anyway, by its very nature, cannot be long drawn out or have an organic character. It will almost always be of the restoration and reorganization type, and not of the type proper to the foundation of new states and new national and social structures, parentheses, as was the case in Machiavelli's The Prince, in which the aspect of restoration was only theoretical, that is, bound up with the literary concept of an Italy descending from Rome, which must restore the order and power of Rome, which is ironic, not using their strategies.
Read the footnote.
In addition to the examples offered by the great absolute monarchies of France and Spain, Machiavelli was inspired to his conception of this necessity of a unitary Italian state by the memory of Rome. It must be shown, however, that Machiavelli is not on this account to be confused with the literary rhetorical tradition, especially because this element is not exclusive and not even predominant. And the necessity for a great national state is not deduced from it. And also because even in the reference to Rome is less abstract than it appears, is placed correctly in the climate of humanism in the Renaissance. In book 7 of The Art of War, we read, this province, Italy, seems born of the reviving dead things, as we have seen with poetry, painting, and sculpture. Why should it not therefore rediscover military virtue, etc.? His remarks of this kind will be grouped together to establish their exact character. That's the footnote. So the answer is, you know, of course, it's not the actual re-embodiment of Rome. it sounds like. It will have a defensive and not an originally creative character. It is presupposed that there is an already existing collective will which is innervated. What's that word mean?
Drained of life or vitality.
That's a good word.
It's
a
great word.
That's a good word. That's like, what is it? The primordial ooze?
Yeah, primordial ooze.
Innervated.
Very Ninja Turtles.
Right, right. Innervated, dispersed. Which is, sorry, I just pictured the Ninja Turtles as four heads of Marxism, and I'm just like, hold on.
Teenage Marxist Ninja Turtles.
Any listeners, no Grant and no Photoshop want to do that for us, please
send Turtles with a ham sick. Turtle power. No, people power. There we go.
There we go.
This has been the worst dad joke. Where was I?
We were on dispersed, which has suffered.
Which has suffered a dangerous and threatening but not decisive and catastrophic collapse, and which it is necessary. Sorry, in which it is necessary to reconcentrate and strengthen, and not that a collective will is to be created ex novo, originally, and to be directed towards very concrete and rational ends, but ends whose concreteness and rationality have not yet been verified and criticized by an effective and universally known historical experience. Holy shit, somebody else want to take over? I feel like I just read, like,
a book. I can take over.
He said a lot.
Yeah. The abstract character of Sorel's conception of the myth is apparent from his aversion, which takes the emotional form of ethical repugnance for the Jacobins. Fuck you, Rousseau. Who were certainly a categoric incarnation of Machiavelli's prince. The modern prince must contain a part dedicated to Jacobinism in the integral significance which this notion has had historically and ought to have conceptually. As an example of how a collective will was formed and operated concretely, which in at least some of its aspects was an original creation ex novo, it is necessary to define collective will and political will in general in the modern sense. Will as working consciousness of historical necessity, as protagonist of the real and effective historical drama. He's leaning hard into Sorel, which either tells me he really, really likes Sorel, or Mussolini really, really likes Sorel, and I'm not sure which one it is.
He hates Sorel.
Okay. I was going to say, I think it's
confused me for a second. Okay,
this is like these Ricardo.
These are all digs directly at Mussolini. Yeah,
this is like Ricardo for Marx, I feel like.
Yeah. But this is very pointed at Sorel. So, like, did Mussolini go head over heels for Sorel in some way I'm not aware of?
Sorel was one of the biggest.
That makes sense with the nationalism and stuff, you know, and the building of the myth.
Well, it wasn't like he foundational like syndicalism's ideas. I don't.
Sorel was a syndicalist, but he was
biggest guys for syndicalism and social democracy.
Yeah, yeah, which I guess supposedly was Mussolini's background too, right?
And then
at
the end of his life, he switched over to fascism.
Yeah. So,
well, right, like, wasn't it like a split between the syndicalists and the communists that bought a gun and shit?
You know,
quoted by Mussolini even as a defense.
So there you go. So Mussolini was crushing on
Sorel. Was also a quote unquote pragmatist, where all of his things had to be quite pragmatic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
dare to invent the future, you motherfuckers.
So this is definitely like eking around the censors of smacking at the fascists that every time he's bringing up Sorel, which makes sense. Anyway, one of the first parts ought in fact to be dedicated to the collective will, posing this question in this way. When can the conditions for the arousing and development of a national popular collective will be said to exist? Hence, a historical, parentheses, economic analysis must be made of the social structure of the given country, together with a dramatic presentation of the attempts made throughout the centuries to arouse this will and the reasons for the successive failures. Why was there no absolute monarchy in Italy at the time of Machiavelli? One must go back to the end of the Roman Empire. questions of language, the intellectuals, etc., in order to understand the function of the medieval communes, the significance of Catholicism, etc., it is necessary, in fact, to make a sketch of the whole Italian history, synthetic but exact. Gramsci, not everybody has your brain, man.
This just reminds me of how everyone was making fun of Putin during that Tucker Carlson thing. Did you not see that, David?
I saw Putin on there.
Which part? When he was like,
He was like, so I'm going to tell you why we invaded Ukraine, but we have to go back to the 900 AD.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I loved that shit. Cause like,
it's just like this. Putin is actually a Gramsciist.
I just love that they're like, the history lesson was so boring. And it's like, dude, you wouldn't fight. He asked you, is this going to be a talk show or a serious conversation? Like at the very beginning, because he saw what you were doing. You answered a serious conversation. You said it should have just fucking said talk show. I bet you he would have played ball, you know?
There's some great man theory fucking mystical future where someone hands Putin Gramsci and he goes, oh, communists are my buddies now.
He was, maybe he's still a KGB sleeper agent just waiting to do the Simpsons gag.
There you go. The reason for the successive failures of the attempts to create a national popular collective will is to be sought in the existence of certain social groups, which were formed by the dissolution of the communal bourgeoisie, and in the particular character of other groups, which reflect on the international function of Italy as the seat of the church and the depositary of the Holy Roman Empire, etc. This function and the consequent position led to an internal situation which can be called economico-corporative. That is, politically, the worst forms of feudal society, the least progressive and the most stagnant. There were always lacking and could not be constituted an efficient Jacobin force, such as a force in which in other nations awakened and organized on the national popular collective will and founded the modern states. Do the conditions for this will finally exist? Or what is the present relationship between these conditions and the forces opposed to them? Traditionally, the opposing forces have been the landed aristocracy and more generally landed property in all its forms, in which its characteristic Italian trait, which is a special rural bourgeoisie, heir to the parasitism bequeathed to modern times by the ruin as a class of the communal bourgeoisie, the hundred cities, the cities of silence.
So just in the text, rural bourgeoisie is in quotations, and that's actually very important. Because rural bourgeoisie here is not actually rural bourgeoisie. These were old rural aristocrats and, you know, feudal landowners who just slowly shifted their holdings to also being capital owners. But they're still also aristocrats. So it's like this fucking horrible amalgamation where they just control everything in the rural areas.
Just nobles turn landlords turn.
It's like the company town's natural origin.
Yeah.
It's like if the company town just existed out of thousands of years of heritage.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. That's what he's referring to as rural bourgeoisie.
That's like all of Mexico. They came from the Habsburgs. That's what? How Mexico's founded by the Habsburgs. Yeah.
Yeah.
So like the entire Mexican state and its, you know, eugenics project kind of makes sense.
Oh, I did not realize the Habsburgs did that.
Yeah, no, a lot of people don't realize the Habsburgs are kind of like the start of Mexico, and it's like, oh, that's why you had that complex caste system.
Who do you think was in control of Spain when all of this happened?
Yeah, that's true. The Habsburgs were everywhere. That was a massive dynasty.
Well, they fucked everybody, including each other. So,
oh yeah, there's a reason. Like the only two entities that were on their side during World War I were wonky position Germany and also dying Ottoman Empire.
You know what's crazy, completely unrelated to this reading, is that the Dutch still have a Pledge of Allegiance to the Spanish monarchy in their national anthem or something.
What?
Oh, all right. Wait.
Europe is so fucked up.
The Dutch plunged Europe into the 80 Years' War over this shit, and they still pledge allegiance to Spain.
That's a cuck move.
Europe is so weird and shallow and backstabby and in charge of the rest of it. And fucking, I know we've talked about here. I know, Mark's Madness side, at least way back, we did Imperialism by Lenin, which was breaking down the financial and the banks and the
moribund capitalism, as Stalin called it.
Yes, moribund capitalism. And that pointed to, the Western Front in World War I largely being determined by the scramble for Africa, including around Morocco. But then there's also the much more publicized and the ones historians point to, and that's the start of the Eastern Front in World War I, which centers around, the collapse of the Habsburgs and the Ottomans and vying for control to colonize Eastern Europe. And it's just that kind of nasty slap fighty, we're all in charge of you, and shifting backstabby alliances.
You got to remember, a lot of these people
it's just family. Expanded from Europe.
This is family relations played into politics a lot of times. These people literally hung out as kids together and shit.
Oh yeah.
Family retreats. And it's of course they're going to have petty squabbles and people's lives are going to be killed over. That's why feudalism is fucking bad.
Yeah.
Families shouldn't rule over entire countries forever. What the fuck?
Back to the reading. The positive conditions are to be sought in the existence of urban social groups conveniently developed in the field of industrial production, who have reached a certain level of historical political culture. Any formation of a national popular collective will is impossible unless the great mass of peasant cultivators breaks simultaneously into political life. Machiavelli understood this, and by his reform of the militia, which is what the Jacobins did in the French Revolution, and in this understanding, we can see the precocious Jacobinism of Machiavelli, the germ, more or less fertile, of his conception of the National Revolution. All history since 1815 shows the efforts of the traditional classes to prevent the formation of a collective will of this kind, to maintain their economico-cooperative power in an international system of passive equilibrium.
See, what's weird is our traditional communities are what if everybody was equal and everybody, was in charge? And so this stuff is super European.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not a fucked up slap fight but behind aristocrats. Come on now.
Well, we have, bourgeois assholes, but they certainly aren't the people being hey, we should have our own nation. They're actually, we should remain the tribal council. And who cares that we have treaties that are being broken? It's oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll just never solve those problems. We'll just paste over them. Sounds good.
An important part of the modern prince will have to be devoted to the question of intellectual and moral reform, that is, to the question of religion or world outlook. In this field, we also find a traditional absence of Jacobinism and fear of Jacobinism, the latest philosophical expression of which fear is the Malthusian standpoint of B. Crochet towards religion. The modern prince must and
cannot. B. Crochet makes me feel like it's Big Pharma.
No, this is
Crochet.
It's Benedetto
Croquet. Croquet. Sorry, I thought this was
Crochet,
who
Gramsci
studied under, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, okay.
No, I just think B. Crochet is Big Crochet.
Oh no, yeah.
Totally COVID brain. Sorry.
my understanding was that Gramsci studied under fascist Italy's fascist Italy's version of Sam Harris, and we will stick with that.
what a terrible fucking Sam Harris.
The modern prince must and cannot be the preacher and organizer of intellectual moral reform, which means creating the basis for a later development of the national popular collective will towards the realization of a higher and total form of modern civilization. These two fundamental points, the formation of a national popular collective will, of which the modern prince is, at the same time, the organizer and active working expression, and a moral and intellectual reform, should constitute the structure of the work. The concrete points of the program must be incorporated in the first part, i.e. they should result dramatically from the discourse and not be a cold and pedantically reasoned exposition. Can there be a cultural reform and an uplifting of the civilization of the depressed strata of society without there first being an economic reform and a change in their social position and a place in the economic world? That is a good dig at the Jacobins. Let's just give everybody an equal vote. Don't do what the fuck did they have in the French Revolution? Was it active and passive citizenship? So I get being like, fuck that, but what good is it without economy? Thank you, Gramsci.
Well, that's also a dig at the Soviets, who did the opposite, where they're just like, we're going to change the economy and people are going to follow.
Yeah, yeah, that's true too.
It's really a build it and they will come mentality.
Right, right, right. You've got to sit there and do the actual cultural work.
You got to form real relationships with the people you're mm-hmm. trying to lead. Like, you can't just show up and be like, I'm here to lead you. Like, yeah. When I first started going back to my reservation and stuff, like, what people said was, you know, it's not like we don't want change. It's just we're waiting for the right leaders. You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you gotta show people you can lead them. They're not just going to follow, you know?
Yeah, no. Well, and to the same thing too. It's not just economics, but you have to reckon with the histories and things that brought you to those political, economic, and social relations and, you know, adapt your strategies and your vision forward to that, to right all the wrongs and oppression of any masses, you know?
It's called like dialectical materialism. I don't know.
Deal with that contradiction. Come on. intellectual and moral reform must be tied to a program of economic reform. Moreover, the program of economic reform is precisely the concrete way in which every intellectual and moral reform is presented. The modern prince, in developing itself, changes the system of intellectual and moral relations, since its development means precisely that every act is conceived as useful or harmful, as virtuous or wicked, only insofar as it has the modern prince itself as a point of reference and helps to increase its power or oppose it. The prince takes the place in the conscious of the divinity or of the categorical imperative and becomes the basis of a modern lycism, of a complete lycization of the whole of life and of all customary relations.
That's the non-religious control of society.
Yeah, secularism is what most people would just call that. But lycism apparently also works. So cool.
Lycism.
Gramsci doling out the extra fancy words today.
Well, lycism is different than secularism.
Oh, shit. Okay. Yeah, you're wrong, David. Duh.
Yeah, I'm about to get schooled. This is why Prez is here. This is why Prez is here.
Lycism is like the policies and being of the state takes a semi-religious.
Oh, this is like when people are like, the state becomes their god. It? This is like no gods, yeah. No master.
Oh, we talked about that in the last section when we were in summarized with statolatry too, you know, and we of course see this.
What did you just say? I didn't read last chapter. Statolatry?
Statolatry, yes.
State worship.
Yeah, state worship. Basically, and statolatry in that sense is a little less like, not quite, you know, oh my God, the founding fathers, and we have to look through the great constitution. Like, not statolatry in that sense. It was statolatry in the sense that, like, if we just seize over the state, you know, we'll get everything we want with no examination to the social relations and the economy and all
of
those
things. You don't have to correct anything. You could just lay hold of the ready.
Lay hold, yeah. Exactly.
Oh,
yeah,
that idea.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I see that. Yeah.
Lysism is like we should get rid of ecclesiastics and the clerics and replace it all with the state, kind of.
What's ecclesiastic? What the
fuck? Ecclesiastic is a Catholic church.
Okay, sorry. I know the book in the Bible.
Ecclesiastical is relating to the church. So the ecclesiastics would be like the priests, the bishops, the church administrators, all that
now stuff. I'm like, what's in that book? I don't remember what's in that book, but I bet you it's a lot about the church.
Yeah. There was a guy in there. I know that.
Was his name Ecclesiastes? Anyway, we should end the episode.
I think that book had a main character because it introduced real late.
You got a little bit of foreshadowing about Midway and the exposition, but really, you know,
yeah.
Terrible pacing. That. You got like this much of the book.
A lot of weird mini stories with hair and water and stuff.
No, those are the best books. I like the one. It's like a talking donkey. He's like, what the fuck? Quit hitting me. And the dude's just like, there's an angel. And it's like, you're not going to talk about your donkey talking to you? Are you serious? That motherfucker just called you out for beating him. Somebody talk about this, please. But anyway.
With that, as we make ecclesiastical jokes, that is where we will wrap up. We're
going to start a Bible study.
God.
Maybe. No.
Worst acoustic Bible guitar. Study in history.
Actually, I would imagine my Bible study would probably be one of the best ones. It would not be informative.
But with that, next time we'll be starting on the science of politics on slide 177. But that is where we will leave off today.
You got to remember, I used to like teach at kids' church when I was like 14 and an atheist. So I was apparently doing a good enough job. Parents were like, yeah, my kids are learning the Bible. You know, the entire time I'm like, but you know, you should kind of like wonder why Moses came down with different rules. After he went back up and said, I'm going to transcribe them exactly how they were before. And then you get like, don't cook a baby goat in its mother's milk. And you're like, what? Why? Anyway, that happened. Read the Bible. Don't read the Bible. Fucking don't read the Bible. What am I saying?
Maybe anyway, this has been Mark's Madness Pod, part of Chuggalooza Network. We read books. There's a number of ways you can get a hold of us if you'd like to take away the plug, Shimani, too.
Yeah, sorry, COVID brain. Hard to wrap up when I'm telling people to read the Bible. So marksmadness@gmail.com, chuggalootanetwork@gmail.com, or personally yell at me at bandsofturtleisland@gmail.com. You can also get a hold of us on the Zitter. I think that's what people are calling it now. You can zit us at Mark's Madness Pod or at chunkaluta.org, I think is what it has to be. I think we've been banned a lot. Anyway, I don't manage the network Twitter anymore for a reason. Let's see, you have like an Instagram and stuff. You can find all of that on the link tree, and that's linktr.ee/chunkaluta network. Terrible. But a website's, you know, coming soon, maybe. We have an update on it. I've seen it. It looks nice. Posted it on the Patreon. Very good. Other than that, you know, there's a Patreon if you want to support this work. We're aiming to, I guess it's not really this work it supports, but it does help pay the StreamYard and stuff we record with. And that helps other podcasts and stuff record as well. And then eventually we're going to stream the new news show. Probably just do it on our own stream now. I don't know. There's a, what are we fundraising for right now? There's $1,000 electric bill due by March 8th. That's pretty important to pay for. It's a really fucked up situation. This Anishinaabe family owes $1,000. They just paid $500 literally on the 29th of January. So somehow they racked up a $500 bill. I mean, there's late fees probably involved, but it's like, holy shit. Like, what was your electric like that. I mean, it was cold, but that, geez. Anyway, $1,000 by the 8th, we're at 625. I keep saying 650 because of the five, but it's 625. I've made that mistake like five times today. And so, you know, we're already almost there. Hopefully we'll be done by the time you fucking hear this, to be honest. But if we're not, you know, send the money to Cash Sign Zicato's Tin Can on Cash App or at Zicato on Venmo. Again, you can also become a monthly sustainer of this work. You know, we support 10 households on Pine Ridge with wood, and then we help a lot of houseless people around the continent. And as well as indigenous people who ask, I mean, anybody who asks us, but a lot of it's indigenous people, because that's like the, you know, mass base I'm appealing to. But for the most part, you know, it's whoever asks. So, you know, if you have an issue and you think we can help you, we'll consider it. We have a lot of things going on right now that you can find on the link tree. So, you know, help out and help house people. We've already housed three people this year. Trailers are really cheap. So, you know, any donations you make are just going to go into a trailer fund or to wood if there's not a specific, you know, ask going on. So if you ever have extra money and you're like, oh, I want to help people out, directly help out this organizing, because it's like one of the easiest fucking things you can do to pretend you're organizing is to just give money to people who are, you know, like, money is one of the most significant holdbacks of organizers. And if you're not willing to take those risks, think about supporting an organizer you can verify the work they're doing. And, you know, I invite anybody to come out to Pine Ridge themselves to see what we're doing, hear from the people we've helped. You know, it's, there's a lot of stories from all over. You know, eventually, once the website's up, you'll just be able to see everything live, and we'll have new accounts that are org branded and stuff as the org's bank account comes into existence. You know, you got to file a bunch of shit. So it's, you know, and then it's weird because then, you know, technically you're a 501c3, but at the same time, like, we don't want to be a 501c3. We just want access to grant money, because there's a bunch of people who have access to grant money and are wasting it on my reservation. So it may be, if we had responsible people with access to those grants, we could actually help people. I don't know. That's the idea, at least. And then we're working with a lot of different programs out there to accomplish our goals. So, you know, we're working on building a distribution center this year that's going to serve as the administration building for the Achete Shakaween. As this spring, they're demanding the BIA and tribal council cease operations on our land and reestablishment of the 1868 land claims, as there was no legal precedent to remove them. Basically what happens is two senators decide, we're going to give you smaller reservations despite the treaty saying no new negotiations. There is no way you are legally allowed to do that in international law. So, you know, of course, as we see with Palestine, international law doesn't really matter. So there needs to be more done around the subject. And that's why I'm informing the communist movement about it, is that there's a national liberation struggle that's going to go on. You should know about it and you should help it to be more advanced and do more, because there's only one way the fucking revolution happens, and it's through action and a fulcrum point. So here's an easy one. If you don't know, the Ochete Shakaween land stretches from like fucking Georgia over to the fucking like North Alberta. So it's, you know, as long as they're still back in Israel, there's a significant land claim in the middle based on those same exact arguments that, you know, you can use to stress the contradictions in U.S. policy, that they don't actually give a shit and it's just lies. Obviously, we know that, but a lot of people still don't. Like, I informed a lot of people about Aaron's self-immolation. It's like people don't pay attention to the news because it sucks. They just hide away from it. And those are the kind of people that you can actually mobilize. Can you get them to pay attention? Yeah. So I talk about this shit because y'all need to be informed about it in case I'm gone, so it can actually be explored by the communist movement, because not a lot of people are talking about it. And the only other person I know that's a communist really talking about it is like Nick Estes, and he's not as plugged in as he wants you to believe. So it's just frustrating. Anyway, those are the plugs. Help us out before it's too late, because we're just running out of time. I mean.
So with that, this has been Mark's Madness Pod, part of Chunkaluta Network. We read books. My name is David.
I'm Chris.
And Shugmani 2 was here with us. Oh, wait, they're back. All right. So
again, yeah, I got to go. And what? Tosha. Wait, was that what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay, bye.
Bye.